own defences were pounded by cannons and weapon batteries. The spear tip of the Sons of Horus slid into the Therian cohort, a blade aimed for the heart. For Marcus Valerius himself, perhaps. The deck shuddered underfoot as the barrage continued, almost lost beneath the incessant ring of explosions and las strikes against the exposed hull. Legionary transports were all around, disgorging hundreds of warriors into the path of the advancing mobile fortress.
Boarders! Boarders reported at the access ramps!
But Marcus's eyes were fixed on the Reaver as its reactor went critical. The bright flare engulfed the Iron General as well, the two combatants dying in each other's embrace. Severus looked up at him from the controls, his face split by a wide grin.
Vice Cesari, we have movement from the Salamanders. They're coming to contain the breakthrough.
Marcus nodded. The nearest forces from the 18th Legion were still 20 kilometers away, too far to stop the inevitable demise of the Therian cohort. Even so, it was good to know that he had been right. The Emperor had placed them in harm's way for good reason. The Salamanders and others would respond, hold the flank, and keep the hope of the remaining loyalists alive.
Multiple boarding parties, Vice Cesari! 100 or more hostiles, moving level by level!
Diadriax, all is ready.
The Magos nodded.
Do it. Overload the reactor.
As the countdown began, Marcus knelt in silent prayer upon the command deck, the Lectitio Divinitatis clasped to his chest. Others among the crew followed his lead. He heard muffled bolt gun fire from the level below. Armored fists hammering against the reinforced door. The rasp and clatter of a chainsword on the metal.
My faith is my shield!
Orders, Colonel.
The request from the driver, followed by the squeal of track brakes, drew Kalsar Vaynid's attention to the visual feed from the front of his executioner tank. The hillside road dropped away a few meters ahead. The Imperial Army colonel unbuckled himself and moved up through the top hatch for a better view. He could see half a kilometer of devastation. An immense crater focused around the tangled remains of a Capital Imperialis mobile fortress. The ground had been riven by an immense detonation. The banks of the depression littered with the still-burning remains of traitor tanks. There were renegade militia among them, and armored vehicles in the livery of the Sons of Horus. The carcasses of two titans were slumped amidst the ruin of the traitor force beside the river. He saw nothing alive.
Move us in. Slowly.
The column followed after them, tracks skidding across the scorched ground, and a cloud of ash and dust joined the billow of exhaust fumes. The Vox hissed for several seconds and then crackled into the voice of Lieutenant Vask.
There must be more than 100 wrecks out there. Did the Salamanders do this?
No. The axis of their counterattack was further north.
Kalsar examined the blackened hull of a land raider as they passed. It was buckled from heavy shelling.
I think the Capital Imperialis did this.
On its own?
The colonel lifted his magnoculars and looked past the pile of broken armor plate, mangled track housings, and twisted columns of the immense chassis. Lines of other wrecks and mounds of charred corpses were piled up the far slope and beyond.
I don't think so. Someone counterattacked before the Salamanders.
Who?
No idea. So many regiments thrown together, all over the Beta Garmin war zone. I don't think even High Command could tell you who is where these days. But someone took it upon themselves to face the Sons of Horus attack, whatever the cost.
From the positioning of the traitor vehicles, the mobile fortress had clearly been the center of the last assault.
These traitor scum would have had us if they hadn't been delayed here. Shame there's nobody left to thank.
The column moved into the shadow of the Super Heavy, fitful flames from broken fluid links and gas exchangers still smouldering in the depths. Something caught his gaze. The tattered remnants of a red and gold banner. Nothing much could be seen of the design. No clue to the identity of the soldiers that had borne it into battle.
Contact!
The cupola gunner racked his heavy bolter as something moved amidst the wreckage.
Wait! Hold your fire!
A man staggered into the open, almost naked, but for a few scraps of his breeches. His skin was burned. Cuts on his chest and arms where he had raised his hands against some close-by detonation. He looked up at the tanks, clasping a dangle of red rag in one hand. Kalsar clambered out of the turret for a closer look.
Who are you?
The stranger looked around.
No. I don't rightly remember.
What regiment?
Forgive me. It's all a bit fuzzy. Could you speak up? I think I've gone a little deaf.
What happened here?
The stranger shrugged.
The battle, I expect. That doesn't really matter now. There is something important. Something I have to tell you.
The colonel stared at the devastation that stretched in all directions.
How could anyone survive this? It's incredible!
The man thrust forward a sheaf of loosely tied pages, their edges scorched. There was handwriting on the tattered cover, but a dirty, broken-nailed thumb obscured the words.
No, my friend. This is a miracle.
The Horus Heresy. The Dark King by Graham McNeil. Read by Danny Webb. Where before there had been light, now there was only darkness. The hot, urgent pulse of near death surged in his veins. The bitter flavor of betrayal, fully expected, yet wholly unwelcome. This was what it would come to, he knew. This was the inevitable result of naive belief in the goodness of the human heart. Death filled his senses, blood coating his teeth, and a sharp reek of it thick in his nostrils. As though it were yesterday, long buried memories of years spent on the night world of Nostromo emblazoned themselves on the forefront of his thoughts. Haunted darkness, punctured by stuttering lumen strips that fizzed in the shimmering, rain-slick streets, and the stillness of a population kept quiescent with fear. From out of this fetid darkness had come illumination and hope, the promise of a better future. But now that hope was dashed as the bright lance of the future seared itself into his thoughts. The death of a world in a great eye, black and gold, watching it burn. Astartes fighting to the death beneath a red-lit sky, a golden eagle cast from the heavens. He screamed in pain as images of destruction and the end of all things paraded before his mind's eye. Voices called out to him. He heard his name, the name his father had bestowed upon him and the one his people had given him in the fearful watches of the dark. He opened his eyes and let the visions fade from his mind as the sensations of the physical world returned to him. Blood and salty tears stung his eyes and he looked over to the sound of voices calling his name. Horrified faces stared at him in fear, but that was nothing new. Babble spewed from their mouths, but he could make nothing of it, the sense of the words lost in the screaming white noise filling his skull. What sight could be so terrible? What could evoke such horror? He looked down as he realized he squatted atop another living, breathing figure. A giant in torn golden robes, his bone-white hair spattered with gleaming ruby droplets. A mantle of red velvet, trimmed with golden weave, spread out beneath him like a bloodstain. Tanned iron flesh, open and bleeding. He took in the destruction wrought on the body beneath him, raising his hands, balled into fists. Blood dripped from his fingertips, and he could taste the warm richness of the genetic mastery encoded into every molecule upon his teeth. He knew this giant. His name was legendary. His stony heart and mastery of war unmatched. His name was Rogel Dorn. He looked up again as he heard his own name, given voice by a warrior in the golden plate armor of the Imperial Fists who bore the black and white heraldry of his first captain. He knew this warrior too. "Curse!" cried Sigismund. "What have you done?" The emptiness of space shimmered in the glow of distant suns beyond the armored glass. Faraway planets and unknown systems turned in their prescribed arcs without thought for the dramas being played out on the stage of human endeavor. What did those who lived beneath these suns know of the Cheror system and the blood that had been shed to pacify it in the name of the emergent Imperium of Mankind? Curse stifled the anger such questions provoked, staring into his reflection with cold obsidian eyes that resembled empty sockets in his pallid, sunken features. Lank hair hung to his neck like black ropes and spilled across his wide, powerful shoulders. He turned from his reflection, uncomfortable with the dreadful disappointment he saw there. Glinting metal caught his sullen gaze. His armor, standing in a shadowed alcove on the far wall. He crossed the chamber and placed his hand on the skull-faced helmet. The gem-like facets of its lenses winked in the low light, and the sweeping dark wings rose from its sides like the pinions of some avenging angel of the night. The burnished plates were dark, as befitted the Primarch of the Night Lords, each one contoured perfectly to his form and worked with gold edging that caught the starlight. Turning from his battle armor, he paced the hard metallic floor of the gloomy, cavernous chamber that confined him. Thick steel columns supported a great vaulted ceiling, its upper reaches lost in shadow. And the hum of the mighty Starfort's reactor beat like a pulse in the metal. This aesthetic of functional austerity was typical of the Imperial Fists, whose artifice had constructed this mighty orbital fortress as a base of operations with which to begin the compliance of the Cheror system. The Emperor's children had held their traditional victory feast before the first shot had been fired, and together with Fulgrim's Legion and the Night Lords, Rogel Dorn's Imperial Fists had broken open the defenses of the belligerent human coalition that resisted the coming of the Imperium. Within 8 months of hard, bloody fighting, the Eagle flew above the smoking ruins of the last bastion. But where Dorn lauded Fulgrim's Legion, the conduct of the Night Lords had earned only his ire. Matters had finally come to a head amid the silver ruins of Osmium. Pyres of the dead stained the skies black, and Kurz had watched his chaplains orchestrating the executions of defeated prisoners when Dorn marched into his camp, his lean face thunderous.
"Kurz!"
Never once had Rogel Dorn called him by his forename.
"Brother,"
he had replied.
"Throne, what are you doing here?"
demanded Dorn, his normal affable tone swallowed in the depths of his outrage. A phalanx of gold-armored warriors followed their lord, and Kurz had immediately sensed the tension in the air.
"Punishing the guilty,"
he had answered coolly.
"Restoring order."
The Primarch of the Imperial Fists shook his head.
"This is not order, Kurz. It is murder. Order your warriors to stand down. My Imperial Fist will take over this sector. Stand down,
said Kurz.
Are they not the enemy?
Not anymore, said Dorn. They are prisoners now, but soon they will be a compliant population and part of the Imperium. Have you forgotten the Emperor's purpose in declaring the Great Crusade?
To conquer, said Kurz.
No, said Dorn, placing a golden gauntlet on his shoulder guard. We are liberators, not destroyers, brother. We bring the light of illumination, not death. We must govern with benevolence if these people are ever to recognize our authority in this galaxy.
Kurz flinched at the touch, resenting the easy friendship Dorn pretended. Bilious anger bubbled invisibly beneath his skin, but if Dorn was aware of it, he gave no sign.
These people resisted us and must pay the penalty for that crime, said Kurz. Obedience to the Imperium will come from the fear of punishment. You know that as well as anyone, Dorn. Kill those that resisted, and the others will learn the lesson that to oppose us is to die.
Dorn shook his head, taking his arm to lead him away from the curious stares their heated discussion was attracting.
You are wrong, but we should speak of this in private.
No,
said Kurz, angrily shrugging off Dorn's grip.
You think these people will bend the knee meekly to us because we show compassion? Mercy is for the weak and foolish. It will only breed corruption and eventual betrayal. Fear of reprisals will keep the rest of this planet in check, not benevolence.
Dorn sighed.
And the hatred planted in those you leave alive will pass from one generation to the next until this world is engulfed in a war, the cause of which none of those fighting will remember. It will never end. Don't you see that? Hate only breeds hate, and the Imperium cannot be built upon such bloody foundations.
All empires are forged in blood,
said Kurz.
To pretend otherwise is naive. The rule of law cannot be maintained by the blind hope that human nature is inherently good. Haven't we seen enough to know that ultimately the mass of humanity must be forced into compliance?
I cannot believe I am hearing this, said Dorn. What has got into you, Kurz?
Nothing that has not always been there, Dorn,
said Kurz, striding away from the mighty golden figure and hauling one of the few remaining prisoners upright by the front of his tunic. He scooped up a fallen bolter and thrust the heavy gun into the prisoner's trembling hands. Kurz leaned down and said,
Go ahead. Kill me.
The terrified man shook his head, the oversized weapon shaking in his hands as though his limbs were palsied.
No, said Kurz. Why not?
The prisoner tried to speak, but so awed by the terrifying proximity of the Primarch that his words were unintelligible.
Are you afraid that you will be killed?
The man nodded, and Kurz addressed his warriors.
No one harms this man. No matter what happens, he is not to be punished.
Kurz had turned and walked back towards Dorn, with his arms stretched out to either side of him and presenting his back to the prisoner. No sooner had he turned away from the armed man than the gun had been raised and the hard crack of a bolter shot split the air. Sparks flew as the explosive shell ricocheted from Kurz's armor, and he spun on his heel to smash the prisoner's skull to splinters with his fist. The headless corpse swayed for a moment before dropping slowly to its knees and pitching onto its chest.
You see,
said Kurz, his fingers dripping blood and bone fragments.
And what was that supposed to prove?
Asked Dorn, his features curled in distaste.
That any chance mortals get, they would choose the path of descent. When he thought he would be punished, he dared not shoot. But the moment he believed himself free from consequence, he acted.
That was an unworthy deed, said Dorn.
And Kurz had turned away from him before he could elaborate, but the Imperial Fist Primarch caught his arm.
Your warriors will stand down and withdraw, Kurz. That is an order, not a request. Leave this planet now.
Dorn's eyes were hard as granite, and Kurz knew enough of his brother's resolve to realize he had pushed him far enough.
When this campaign is won, you and I will have words, Kurz. You have crossed the line, and I will no longer countenance your barbarous methods of war. Your way is not the way of the Imperium.
I think you might be right, whispered Kurz.
And as he led his warriors from the field of battle, their dark armor rendering them as shadows in the ruins, he wondered what might have happened had he taken the debate to his logical conclusion. Kurz shied away from the violence inherent in such a line of reasoning and ran a hand through his dark hair, feeling like a caged animal as the door to his chamber, his prison, slid open and a warrior in gleaming midnight blue armor entered. Through the door, he could see the purple armored figures of Fulgrim's Phoenix Guard, their golden halberds and copper scale cloaks glittering in the wan light of the Starfort. Dorn and Fulgrim were taking no chances with his confinement. The newcomer's head was shaven bald, pale and angular, with hooded eyes of jet beneath a prominent brown and pugnacious jawline. Kurz nodded in acknowledgement at the sight of his equerry, Captain Shang, and beckoned him in with an impatient wave of his hand.
What news?
Asked Kurz as Shang bowed curtly before him. Shang said,
The Master of the Fist recovers, my lord. A lesser being than a Primarch would be dead thrice over with the wounds you dealt him.
Kurz returned his gaze to the tracks of stars beyond the skin of the Starfort, all too aware of the severity of Dorn's wounds, having clawed them with his bare hands and teeth.
Then I must await the judgment of my peers, is that it?
With respect, my lord, you did draw the blood of a brother Primarch.
And for that, they will demand blood in return, no doubt.
He remembered Dorn coming to his chambers, enraged by the slaughters on Cherort, and incensed at what Fulgrim had told him. Secrets Kurz had told Fulgrim in confidence some days earlier. The fit had come upon Kurz as the Phoenician had told him tales of Chemos, pitching him to the floor and racking his mind with terrifying visions of a nightmare future of death and unremitting darkness. Moved by Fulgrim's apparent concern, Kurz had confided in his old tutor, telling him the visions that had plagued him since his earliest days on Nostromo.
A galaxy of war, Astartes turning on one another, death awaiting him at his father's hands.
Fulgrim's pale, aquiline features had remained stoic, but Kurz had seen the unease that flickered in his eyes. He had hoped Fulgrim would keep his confession in confidence, but when Dorn had appeared at his door, he knew he was betrayed. In truth, he had little memory of what had occurred after Dorn's storming accusations of insult to the Emperor. The present had faded, and the future had seized his mind with agonizing visions of a galaxy locked in a cycle of unending war, where the alien, the mutant, and the rebel arose to feast on the rotting carcass of the Imperium. This, then, was the future the Emperor was creating. This was the ultimate destiny of a galaxy where the fear of punishment was not the agent of control. This was the inevitable result of allowing weak men to craft the destiny of mankind. And Kurz knew that of all the Primarchs, only one had the force of will required to mold the new Imperium from the soft clay of its present form.
The time has come to forge our own path, Shang, said Kurz.
Then this is the moment you foresaw?
Yes, my brothers will seize this opportunity to be rid of us.
I believe you are correct, agreed Shang. My sources tell me there is talk, and not idle talk, of recalling the Legion to Terra to account for our methods of war.
I knew it. Since they cannot kill me, the cowards choose to strike at me through my legion. You see, Shang, they've been waiting for this opportunity for decades. They are weak fools who have not the stomach to do what must be done. But I do. Oh, yes. I do indeed.
Then what is our course, my lord?
Asks Jang.
Fulgrim and Dorn may have betrayed me, but we are not without friends amongst the other legions,
said Kurz.
But first, we must put our own house in order.
Tell me, what news of Nostromo?
It is as we feared, my lord, said Shang. The regime of Administrator Regent Balthius has failed. Corruption is rife, criminals govern from the ruined spires of Nostromo Quintus, and lawlessness is endemic.
Then I have no time to waste while small-minded fools decide my fate as though I am a lowly menial to be chastised.
What are your orders, my lord? Asked Shang.
Ready our ships, Captain, said Kurz. We return to Nostromo.
But you've been ordered to remain in seclusion, my lord, pointed out Shang. Lord Fulgrim's Praetorians and Dorn's Templars guard your chambers. Kurz grinned crookedly and said,
Leave them to me.
Kurz lifted the last piece of his armor from the shadowed alcove and raised it above his head. He turned towards the door of his chamber and lowered his helmet until the skull-faced visor connected to his gorget with a hiss of pressurization. His vision shifted subtly, and his perceptions broadened as he blended with the shadows of the dimly lit chamber. He slowed his breathing and stretched out his senses. The darkness, a second home to him after so many years spent in its embrace as a predator on the weak and guilty.
He felt a moment's regret that it had come to this, but he quashed such notions viciously. Doubt, regret, and hesitancy were weaknesses others might suffer from, but not Conrad Kurz.
His breathing deepened, and the tenebrous chamber came alive to him. Kurz felt power in the darkness, the cold intellect of hunters and creatures of the night that killed beneath its cloak. Lethal instincts honed on 1,000 battlefields were now heightened to undreamed-of levels and would now serve him equally well on this one. He spread his arms wide, and a ripple of psychic force pulsed like the blast wave from an explosion with Kurz at its epicenter. The hanging glow strips filling the chamber exploded in quick succession, detonating one after another in showers of pellucid sparks. Broken glass tinkled musically to the steel deck in a glass rain. Sputtering power cables swayed from the ceiling, hissing and fizzing like angry snakes as electrical discharge strobed blue across the room. Hostile red warning lights blinked. Cold light eased inside. The door opened, and a handful of armored warriors stood silhouetted. Kurz leapt straight up, gripping the open lattice structure of the nearest column and swinging himself up into the deeper darkness of the chamber before the light could reach him. His legs swung around the column, and he climbed higher as the warriors spread out with their halberds extended before them. He heard them call his name, their voices echoing in the darkness. A twist of muscle, and he was airborne, a glimmering shadow of dead stars and extinction. The warriors below would have the senses of their battle plate to penetrate the darkness, but they paled in comparison to those of the Night Lord's Primarch. Where others saw only light and dark, Kurz saw all the myriad hues and shades that were invisible to those who had not become one with its fuliginous depths. One of the Phoenix Guard stood directly beneath him, scanning the chamber for its captive occupant, unaware that his doom lurked in the shadows above. Kurz spun around the column, looping lower with each revolution and holding his hand out like an axe blade. The warrior died with his head sliced cleanly from his shoulders, the iron flesh of the Primarch smashing through his armored gorget. No sooner was the blow delivered than Kurz was in motion, swooping through the darkness like a shadow. Cries of alarm echoed as his jailers realized he was amongst them, stabbing beams of helmet lamps crisscrossing madly as they sought to pinpoint his location. With skill born of decades spent as a murderous hunter of men, Saboteurs ghosted invisibly between the beams of light. Another warrior fell with his torso ripped open, blood squirting from torn arteries like ruptured pressure hoses. Gunfire split the darkness, starbursts of muzzle flashes as the warriors opened fire on their unseen attacker. None came close. For wherever they fired, Kurz was already far from harm's way, spinning through the air like a malignant phantom and twisting between the bolts and wildly slashing blades. One of Dawn's Templars backed towards a pool of light, and Kurz slid through the darkness towards him, moving impossibly silently for an armored warrior. A sensation unlike anything he had felt previously danced in his blood, and Kurz savored it as he understood it for what it was. Contrary to Gilliman's rash pronouncement, it seemed Astartes could know fear. This fear, such as it was something to be treasured. Mortal fear was a rancid, sweaty thing, but this was caged lightning in the marrow. Kurz pounced towards the armored Templar, one of Dawn's best and bravest. Veteran or not, he died as any other man did, in blood and agony.
Death haunts the darkness,
shouted Kurz.
And he knows your names.
He could hear frantic calls for reinforcements, but the superior systems of his own armor easily jammed them as he took to the air once more and vaulted from shadow to shadow.
No one is coming,
he said.
You are going to die alone here.
Spraying blasts of gunfire followed his pronouncements as the warriors sought to pinpoint his location in the darkness. But Kurz owned the darkness, and no matter what light or senses these warriors depended upon, they were not nearly enough to stop him from killing them. He could see the survivors, a Templar and two of the Phoenix Guard, backing towards the door. They now realized this was a fight they could not win, but had made the mistake of thinking that a fight with Conrad Kurz was one you could walk away from. Laughing with the joy of the hunt, a pleasure he had forgotten without worthy prey to test him, he soared through the air and dropped into their midst like an assassin. His fist punched through the armor of the first Phoenix Guard, and Kurz wrenched his victim's spinal column out. Leaving the bloody curve of crushed bone protruding from the gaping wound, he snatched the dead warrior's halberd and dropped to the floor as the other warriors turned towards the agonized scream. Before they could react, Kurz swept the halberd out in a wide circular arc above the deck. The energized edge cut through the battle plate, meat and bone, with a searing electric tang. Both warriors fell to the deck, grunting in pain as they collapsed onto the bloody stumps of their legs. Kurz hurled his stolen halberd aside and blocked a return strike from the fallen Phoenix Guard. He snapped his enemy's weapon in two and jammed the splintered ends through his chest. The Templar roared in anger, managing to get off a shot before Kurz was upon him. He ripped the weapon from his victim's grip and planted one knee on his chest, the other on his left arm. The pinned warrior reached up with his free arm to strike at him. Kurz caught the blow and ripped the arm from its socket. Emergency lights began kicking in with a rising hum and a thump of relays, and the chamber was suddenly illuminated with a harsh white glow that dispelled the shadows and banished the darkness. Where before there had been darkness, now there was only light. And what had once been a place of imprisonment was now an abattoir. Curling arcs of blood spray coated the walls and floor, and shattered, headless, limbless bodies lay strewn about like spilled surgical waste. Kurz smiled at the scene of slaughter and the persona he had worn like a disguise as he had first knelt before his father fell away like a discarded mask. Now he was no longer Conrad Kurz. Now he was the Night Haunter. Night Haunter turned over the last card and his jawline tightened as the familiar pattern emerged once more. The stratagem of his flagship was kept dark. The faint blue light of consoles and hololithic displays, islands of light in the darkness. The Primarch of the Night Lords paid no attention to his surroundings, ignoring the pregnant pressure of anticipation that bristled from every member of his bridge crew. A deck of worn cards sat on the softly glowing lectern before him, their edges scuffed and curled from decades of shuffling and dealing. Little more than a parlor game played by the indolent rich of Nostromo Quintus, he'd since discovered that variations of these cards had been employed in the hives of America and by the tribes of the Frank as a means of divination in the time before old night had descended. The cards apparently corresponded to the stratification of society at the time, with the various suits representing warriors, priests, merchants, and workers. Ancient belief held that the future could be read in the patterns of cards known as the Lesser Arcanoi. But such traditions were outmoded concepts in this colorless, secular galaxy. Except that no matter how thoroughly he shuffled the cards and dealt them on the polished glass of the lectern, the pattern was always the same. The moon, the martyr, and the monster lay in a triangular pattern. The king lay reversed at the feet of the emperor on one side of the pattern, and on the other, also reversed, was the dove, a card academics postulated was a symbol of hope. The card he had just dealt sat at the top of the pattern, a card that had changed little over the centuries, and a meaning of which, though often misinterpreted, was unmistakable. Death. He heard footsteps and looked up to see Captain Shang approaching, clad in his battle plate and wrapped in his ceremonial black cape of gleaming patagium. His helmet's flaring wings framed a death mask of an alien skull, its tusked lower jaw thrust beyond his throat. Behind his equerry, Night Haunter could see the gentle rotating orb of Nostromo displayed on the viewscreen. Thick clouds of pollutants ringed the grey planet, shot through with emphysemic yellows and leprous browns. The radiation-blasted moon of Tenebor was just visible as a sickly orb emerging from the stain-lunged corona of Nostromo's dying sun.
"What is it, Captain?"
asked Night Haunter.
"Word from the quiet chambers, my lord."
Night Haunter chuckled mirthlessly.
"My brothers."
"It would appear so, my lord," said Shang. "The astropath sends a psychic bow wave that appears to indicate a great many vessels approaching through the Imperium."
"Dawn,"
said Night Haunter, returning his attention to the cards before him.
"Undoubtedly. What are your orders, my lord?"
Looking once again at the world of his youth, Night Haunter felt the ever-present anger seething under his skin like hot magma beneath the fragile crust of a dying planet.
"Nostromo was once the very model of a pacified planet, Shang,"
said Night Haunter.
"Its populace was kept compliant through fear of the harsh punishment I would mete out to any who broke my laws. Every citizen knew his place, and to break the law was death."
"I remember, my lord."
"And now we return to this,"
said Night Haunter, sweeping the cards from the lectern to reveal a slowly scrolling list of text.
"A murder every 11 seconds, a rape every 9 seconds, violent crimes increasing exponentially every month, suicide rates doubling every year. Within a decade, there will be nothing left of the ordered world I left behind."
"Without fear of reprisal, humanity reverts to its basest instincts, my lord."
Night Haunter nodded.
"This is it, Shang. The ultimate proof that the Emperor's belief in the goodness of mankind is folly of the worst kind."
Shang hesitated before speaking again.
"Then you intend to go through with the attack?"
"Of course,"
said Night Haunter, staring at the doomed planet.
"Only the most extreme measures will serve as an example of our strength of will. Nostromo is dead to us now. We have come for you all."
The Primarch marched along the central walkway of the Strategium to stand beneath the image of Nostromo. The moon was emerging more fully from behind the planet, and reflected light glinted on the hulls of the Night Lord's fleet. A half century of vessels arrayed themselves in battle formation above the diseased, corrupt boil that was the labyrinthine, crime-ridden spires of Nostromo Quintus. Far below was a great wound in the surface, a plunging chasm his fiery arrival had smashed in the planet's crust. Since he had emerged from its hellish depths, he had known pain and suffering the likes of which others could not even guess. He had borne the pain of his tortured growth and lived with the awful self-knowledge of his own death. And his brothers wondered why he appeared moribund. He heard a commotion beside him, and even before the word went out, Night Haunter could feel the tearing pressure of scores of ships emerging from the gates of the Empyrean, with senses beyond the five possessed by his minions.
"Too late, my brothers," he whispered. "I will be gone before you can stop me."
Night Haunter took one last look at Nostromo and said,
"All ships, open fire!"
Incandescent spears of blinding white light leapt from the barrels of uncounted batteries, stabbing down at the world below. Converging and multiplying their energies, the power of 1,000 caged stars coalesced into a pillar of light thicker than the widest spire of Nostromo Quintus. The great beam dispelled the darkness that shrouded Nostromo. The skies bathed in light and fire, blooming into life as the awful heat of the Night Lord's bombardment ignited the air for kilometers in all directions. The blinding lance of pure energy penetrated the impermeable adamantium crust of Nostromo through the ancient fault line torn by the Primarch's arrival. Unimaginable energies tore downwards through the planet's layers until they reached the core. In a cataclysmic explosion, the likes of which the galaxy had rarely seen. Night Haunter watched the death of Nostromo with cold detachment, feeling the enormity of the action he had just taken settle upon him like a dark shroud. Strangely, it was not the burden he had expected. As he watched the tectonic plates split apart and the molten heat of the planet ooze up to swallow the landscape and burn away the atmosphere, the only sensation of which he was conscious was intense relief. The past was dead, and he had shown that the creed he lived by was more than just empty words. The shockwave of this terrifying act would reverberate around the Imperium and come to the attention of those who, like him, understood the sacrifices needed to preserve the galaxy for humanity. Nostromo burned, and Night Haunter said,
"I take this burden of this evil upon myself, and I will not fear it, for I am fear incarnate."
Horus Heresy. The Lightning Tower by Dan Abnett. Read by Danny Webb.
What are you afraid of? What are you really afraid of?
There was once a fine palace, and it sat like a crown of light upon the top of the world. This was in the latter days, when mankind left his birth rock for the second time, to chase a destiny denied him in a previous epoch. The artisan masters of the many rival Masonic guilds had raised the palace up, block by gilded block, to be a statement of unity, regal and unequivocal. After a dreary, lightless age of strife, the warring tribes and creeds of Terra had been alloyed under one rule, and the palace was intended to symbolize that staggering achievement. All the petty dynasts and ethnarchs, all the clan nations and genseps, all the despots and pan-continental tyrants had been quelled or crushed, overthrown or annexed. Some, the smartest and most prescient, had offered terms and been embraced to the bosom of the new rule. Better fealty than the wrath of the warriors in thunder armor. Better submission than the enmity of the world's new master. It was said that once you had seen him or heard him speak, you were never in doubt again. He was the one, and had always been the one. He had been the emperor long before there was any such office to take. No one knew his birth name because he had always, naturally, been the emperor. Even the artisan masters of the Masonic guilds, famous for their sanctimonious craft wars and vainglorious quarrels, shut up and, in concert, built the palace for him. It was monumental. It was not so much an edifice as a handcrafted landmass. The artisan masters built it upon Terra's greatest mountain range and transformed the monstrous peaks into its bulwarks. It towered above a world laid to waste by centuries of war and perdition. And though that world was being rebuilt, with wondrous cities and architectural marvels blooming in the new age of unity, nothing could match its magnificence. For it was beautiful, a euphoric vision of gold and silver. It was said that when they had finished their task, the artisan masters of the Masonic guilds set down their tools and wept. By the time it was complete, it was the largest single man-made structure in known space. Its footing sank deep into the planet's mantle. Its towers probed the airless limits of the atmosphere. It owned the words, "The Palace Holy," without any need for qualification, as if no other palaces existed. He had blemished that glory. He had raised dark curtain walls around the golden halls and cased the soaring towers in skins of armor 10 meters thick. He had stripped away the jeweled facades and the crystallophantine ornamentation, the delicate minarets and the burnished cupolas. And in their places, he had implanted uncountable turrets and ordnance emplacements. He had dug mighty earthworks out of the surrounding lowlands and fortified them with 1 million batteries. He had yoked platforms into synchronous orbits to guard from above, their weapon banks armed and trained day and night. He had put his men up on the walls, armored in gold and set for the coming war. His name was Dawn, and he was not proud of his work. Vadok Singh, the war mason, had a habit of stroking architectural plans as he laid them out, as if they were a beloved pet. "Necessity," he said, his favorite word, stroking out the revised schemata of the Darwalgari elevation. "It's ugly," said Dawn. He stood away from the table, leaning against one of the planning chamber's thick columns, his arms folded across his broad chest.
"Ugly is what they will do if they find the Annapurna Gate weak and flimsy," Singh replied.
He stood back and lit his bock pipe from a taper, allowing his flock of slaves to finish laying out the designs and adjusting the brass armature of the viewing lenses that would magnify details and project them onto the chamber wall for closer examination. Dawn shrugged. "It's still ugly. The Orbis and Lazulite work encrusting that gate took Menzo of Travert 30 years to complete. Pilgrims flock here simply to see it. They say it surpasses even the Eternity Gate in its aesthetic."
"Aesthetic now?" Singh smiled.
He began to pace, trailing blue smoke from the bowl of his long-stemmed pipe. His slaves followed him up and down the chamber like a timorous litter of young following their mother. Singh was a tall man, taller than the Primarch, but skeletally thin. His guild gene-bred their bloodline to favour height for purposes of surveying and overseeing.
I do so love our conversations, Rogel. They're quite contrary. I mean, you, the warrior, and me, the craftsman, and you lecture me on aesthetics.
I'm not lecturing, Dorn replied. He was aware of Sigismund and Archimus in the corner of the great room, stiffening at the warm mason's use of his forename. Dorn would hear about proper respect and protocol again later.
Well, of course you're not, said Sing. But it is a necessity. I mean, how many legions does the upstart have with him now?
Dorn heard Sigismund rise to his feet. He turned and stared at the first captain of the Imperial Fists. Sigismund glowered back for a second, then left the chamber. Dorn glanced back at the War Mason.
Too many, he said.
Sing held out a long, spindly arm in the direction of the schemata.
So?
Begin work tomorrow at sunrise. Dismantle the gate with care and store the dismantled elements in the vaults. We will put the work back when this is done.
Sing nodded. We will put everything back, thought Dorn. When this is done, we will put everything back the way it was.
A katabatic wind was coming in off the lower bulwarks that night. The palace was so immense, the precipice walls bred their own microclimate. Greasy stars swam in the heat ripple of the palace's new reactors. The void shields were being tested again.
Not a palace. Not the palace anymore. A fortress.
Some of those sullen stars were orbital platforms, catching the last backscatter of the sunlight as Terra turned. Dorn put on a fur-edged robe that had been in his possession since his adolescence on Inwit, and went out to walk the parapets of the Dawalagiri Prospect, to dwell upon its beauty one last time. It was one of the last sections of the palace that remained untouched. Adamantium armor plates, drab pre-stressed rock concrete, and auto turrets had yet to blight its ethereal lines. Soon, though, from the wall, Dorn could see the 500,000 campfires of the Masonic host, the labor army that would invade the prospect come sunrise with their mallets and chisels and cranes. The robe had been his grandfather's, though Dorn had long since understood that no ties of blood linked him to the Inuit ice caste that had raised him. He had been created from another genetic line, that most singular line, in a sterile vault deep beneath him in the buried core of the palace.
Not a palace. Not the palace anymore. A fortress.
Dorn had been built to rule, built to assist in his father's tireless ambition, built to make the hard decisions. He had been made as a Primarch, one of only 20 in the galaxy, engineered by the master architect of mankind, the Arch-Mason of genetic code.
The Imperium needs many things, but foremost it needs the ability to protect itself, to attack when necessary. That's why I gave it 20 strong teeth in its mouth.
Attacking was a remarkably easy thing to do. Dorn's physical prowess humbled all but 20 human beings in creation, and those 20 were his father and his 19 brothers. In Dorn's opinion, the real art was knowing when not to attack. His grandfather, the old Inuit sire, patriarch of the Ice Hive clan, had taught him that. Dorn had been the seventh lost son to be reclaimed. By the time his father's forces found him, he had become a system warlord in his own right, ruling the Inuit cluster as the head of the House of Dorn. His grandfather had been dead 40 winters, but still the warlord had slept with a fur-edged robe across his body at night. His people had called him Emperor, until the true meaning of that title had been demonstrated by 1,000 warships in the Inuit sky. Dorn had gone out to meet his father aboard Phalanx, one ship against thousands. But what a ship! A fortress! His father had been impressed.
Dorne had always excelled in the construction of fortresses. That was why Dorne had returned to Terra with his gene sire. Out of love, out of devotion, out of obedience, yes. But most of all, out of necessity. The stars had turned over, and chaos had spilled out from under them. The brightest of all had fallen, and the unthinkable, the heretical, had become fact. The Imperium was attacking itself. The War Master, for reasons Dorne was quite at a loss to fathom, had turned upon their father and was committing his forces to all-out war. That war would come to Terra. There was no question, it would come. Terra needed to be ready. The palace needed to be ready. His father had asked him, as a personal boon, to return to Terra and fortify it for war. No better man for the task. No better master of defenses. Dorne and his fists, appointed the Emperor's Praetorians, could fend off any attack. Below him, the halls of Terra were silent and the walls deep. The only sound was the distant eternal hum of the Astronomicon. The palace Dorne had armored and defaced sat like a dark crown on the top of the world. Rogel Dorne had built many of the finest strongholds in creation. The city fortresses of Zavamunda, the pylon spire of Galant, the donjons along the Ruthen marches. Impregnable bastions all, palaces for governor lords to rule from. None of them had been so essential as this fortification. None of them had been as painful to accomplish. It had been like blotting out the light or draining a sea. The bright glory of his father's triumph, the enduring monument to unity, had been entombed inside a crude shell of utilitarian defense. All because of Horus. Because of the brightest bastard sun, the bringer of new strife. Dorne heard stone splinter. He looked down. He had punched his fist, his imperial fist, through a block of stone in the parapet. He had barely registered the impact. The block was pulverized. My lord, is everything all right? Archimus had shadowed him from the planning chamber. Never so volatile as Sigismund, Archimus was the master of Dorne's Huskarl retinue. There was a worried look on Archimus's face. Just venting my emotions, Dorne said. Archimus regarded the splintered block. Making work for Sing's artisans, then. Something like that. Archimus nodded. He hesitated and looked out over the high walls towards the distant earthworks of the Mahabharat. You have wrought a wonder, you know. I have ruined one. I know you hate it, but it had to be so. No one could have done it better. Dorne sighed. You're kind, old friend, but my heart is lead. This should never have been necessary. I searched the limits of my imagination, and still I can conceive of nothing that begins to explain this war. Pride and ambition, insult, jealousy, they are not enough, not nearly enough. Not for a Primarch. They're too petty and mortal to drive a Primarch to such extremity. They might provoke an argument, a feud at the worst. They would not split the galaxy in half. Dorne looked up at the night sky. And yet, against all reason, he comes. Gilliman will stop him. Rebute is far away. Rusten, the lion, the Khan. Dorne shook his head. I don't think they'll stop him either. I think he'll roll on until he reaches us.